So in this moment, be here. Be here, wherever here happens to be. In this day and time, we have gathered together to contemplate, to dialogue this that is called...
Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
About it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I mean.
think there's no place to hide.
I wish they'd hurry up with that transmission. I want to go to bed.
I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
Executive Order AUC-3423.
Listen to this, boys.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. The name of the show is Night Shift. And life continues to be like science fiction. And this morning we're going to talk about part of what creates the fabric of our universe, and that is words. It's how we communicate. It's how we profess love. It's how we say how we feel. It's everything. But now, in the age that we've called here on Night Shift, the age of lying, the age of AI, the age of who can tell what's real, and guess what? You can just decide what's fact, what's fiction, what should be said, what shouldn't be said. Free speech is a concept. But whose concept? What is linguistic governance? What is the future of language rights? That's what we're going to talk about here on Night Shift, here on listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. So the question is, who will fight for free speech rights? The ACLU? What role will linguistics play? Where are we heading? In the wake of Charlottesville protests in 2017, the ACLU implemented policy changes regarding its approach to First Amendment cases. They had an internal memo that described a new policy that included a test to assess the impact of proposed speech and the impact of its suppression before they'd even consider taking a First Amendment case. Now, I want to unpack that. I want to talk about where we're headed. I want to talk about free speech. And what better person to do that with than the co-host I have here? And that, of course, is Dr. Kelly Wright. Dr. Kelly Wright, are you here? Are you there? Hello, wait, talk to me. Wait, I think you're muted. I can't hear you. You're not muted? Why can't I hear you? Okay, well, hold on a second. I can't hear you. I may have to get Max in here. All right, hold on. Why can't I hear you? I see you. Okay, let me say something. Okay, talk to me.
Good evening.
Okay.
How are you?
There you. There you are. Okay. So, Dr. Kelly Wright, so tell me, first of all, welcome back to the show.
And, thank you.
And this was a topic before I even, you know, before we even did this show weeks ago, you said to me, Mike, we have to talk about free speech.
Yeah.
We have to. So, you know, free speech is a term, it's a concept. And I guess my question to you first, before we get into anything, is what is your definition of free speech? Or do you do you have a personal definition?
Gosh, no. That's an interesting question. That was something I wasn't really thinking about. It's also something that I've struggled with because I teach a class on profanity and censorship. And in this class, we actually work on rewriting some of the definitions and tests that the Supreme Court uses or other courts use to determine if something is obscene. And in that task of grading other people's ideas of what seems like a better world, or a functional policy has made it really difficult for me to come to these kind of discussions about what is permissible and what's not permissible. Now, why is it difficult?
No. What's permissible? What's not permissible? And why?
And why? Yeah. I also have another idea of freedom and free speech, which I think is the enacting self without, worrying about repercussions or, social faux pas or et cetera. So I think about that in my work when I look raciolinguistics, looking at how the body and language interact with each other. And so thinking about how the body and language interact with each other, has made me recognize that for most of human history, most people have not been able to use language in a way that's entirely free. I don't really know what free speech looks like in the real world. There's probably a lot of reasons for that have nothing to do with social control, right? That just have to do with evolution. But freedom is an elusive concept when it comes to linguistic usage.
Well, it is an elusive concept, and that's why I really want to unpack it tonight, because a few things about it stand out to me. I mean, we have a list of topics to get through on this, but just at the top here, the concept of free speech let me ask you, does that incorporate, and this is not specifically for you, but I'm asking generally, does that incorporate how speech can be weaponized and stopping speech that has been weaponized? And if that's the case, how do you codify that? Because essentially, a lot of what we're talking about is, free speech until it's weaponized.
And you're absolutely right. So if we're taking the American context by itself, our history of the starting from the Bill of Rights and going all the way up until this week when the Supreme Court tried to, took on two cases, and the things that remain on their docket for the rest of the cycle, right? Have to do with determining what harm is. So that's what the courts are interested in. Is finding out how bad is this? Is it so bad that we need to issue an exception, which they've done, and what harms are we interested in, right? So harms against people, harms against corporations, harms against X, Y, ideas like freedom, like how we can freely run our military, right? So these are everything that we've seen actually written in law has to do with understanding harm.
Well, what's interesting about that is because you have to then think about our policies on guns at the same time. I mean, you can't not think that because, how far can we go with free speech? How far can we go with weapons? Can we have automatic weapons? Can we have, weapons of war? Can we have words of mass destruction? Is that okay? And who decides what words are okay? Why are cops antagonistic against, Black Lives Matter and
or
trans or any of those things versus these shooters who can be brought in alive? what happened? Where's the disconnect? So the other thing I wanted your opinion on, and this is, of course, this is without telling you I was going to ask you this, because I feel I'm sure you are somewhat aware that one of the things that has happened in courts, that actually the recording academy had to get involved and create something called the Rap Act for, is where in cases where rappers have been prosecuted for crimes, they use as evidence of their character lyrics from their songs. Now, if that's not a violation of free speech, I don't know what is. And I just want to know your thoughts on that.
I mean, my thoughts as a linguist are my thoughts as, you know, I feel like we're going to be seeing more of that, right? Where people's like public language use gets brought in as like evidence of character without any real regard for artful creation or satire and to me, okay, so fast forwarding, like, to me the person, and maybe not me the researcher, I work in a hip hop studies program at Virginia Tech, my university, and this hip hop studies program, I mean, I walk into that room and I encourage young people to put whatever they need to put into their music, and I'm like, this is what you want to communicate about? Okay, great, let's talk about it, you know. And it could be like, chew guns, get money, whatever, right? I mean, it's not usually, but that's the thing, is like, if that's what you want to rap about, like, let's make it happen. And these sorts of things, these sorts of rulings, these sorts of acts, like, make it very hard for me to like walk into that space and say that in an authentic way. It like changes the way I interact with people, because I again have to tell them, like, actually, you're not as free as I would like you to be. You know, I would love to tell you, just come into this booth and say whatever you want, but I can't like in good conscience do that. I have to at least give you like all of these asterisks and let you choose to do it. So it's tough. It's tough to like nurture in that space.
Well, here's the other thing in it. And of course the science fiction part, and I don't want to get too far ahead because we're going to come back to this point, but okay, if we police speech and there are free speech, there is certain speech that is, you are free to say, and certain speech you are not free. Free speech is really just it's an expression of thought. So what you're really being told is what you can think. And that really comes down to what's happening to teachers. I was going to play this teacher, I think I even sent it to you, who talked about why he was resigning from a certain community in Florida, that he can't teach. He can't do what teaching is, which is ask children to expand their minds, ask young people to go beyond what they know. And so I feel that the real danger of free speech and where we're headed in this fascist-like state that America's become is that we won't be free to think, and we'll be encouraged not to. So, just want to know if you had any thoughts on that, or if you agree, well, do you concur?
A ton. I've got a ton. I mean, it's... So, a lot, I guess, I've got, like, a ton of bullet points here in this development, but I think one overarching point that's maybe important to keep in mind is that, at least in the United States, our First Amendment... You know, this beginning of our Bill of Rights, like our First Amendment that enshrines, you know, the freedom of religion and assembly and speech and the press and our ability to petition the government to make change in a single sentence. Right? That law, that amendment to our Constitution was never meant to cover all people. It was not written with that intention. It was written with the assumption that it would not ever apply to the enslaved or women of any race, or people who were mentally challenged or the indigenous or. And that has never been changed in our law. and it matters for how it's interpreted and how it's been interpreted over time. We can look at other things in our law, like the definition of citizen, which is a fair complexioned person of European descent. That has never been changed in our law. Mm. We can also look at a moment like Obama making lynching a federal crime, because it wasn't. And exactly. By God, yeah. It should have been. Exactly. You know what I mean? Exactly. And so exactly. It's that of like, we can see people actually reaching into the law and making these edits of being like, these types of laws were never meant to protect all people. Let's make sure they do. That has never happened to the First Amendment. Well, and because of that, it's not applied that way.
You know, this is the story of humanity. I mean, let's not even talk about the Bible. But, you know, I'm glad you mentioned this point, because I do want to get into, you know, for most people, the question is, okay, free speech, who will fight for your free speech rights? Like, what do you do? If your free speech rights are being infringed upon, who do you go to? And generally, people think the ACLU. So I just want to get a little bit into this, to unpack this a little bit and get some of your take on it, because you're familiar with this, but I don't know that our listeners are. And these are the considerations, that memo that came out after 2017. These are what they call the considerations specific to speech cases. And it says, in the heading here is, in carrying out the ACLU's commitment to defend freedom of speech, a number of specific considerations may arise. We emphasize that in keeping our commitment to advancing free speech for all, these are neutral principles that apply to all speakers, irrespective of the speaker's particular political views. Now, I like those words, like neutral, you know, irrespective. Those are nice words. I like those words. They suggest things to me. Now, they have 4 points here. And I'm not going to get into all of them, but I'll get into the first one specifically. It says, whether the speaker seeks to engage or promote violence. Now, the first line underscores what you just said. It says, the First Amendment is not absolute. And I got to let that linger for a second. If the First Amendment is not absolute, then what are we hanging on here? You know, there are things, there are words you always hear when you talk about the Constitution. You hear about enshrined in the Constitution. So what does that really mean if it's not absolute? How can something be enshrined and not absolute? Explain that to me, Dr. Wright. I don't
well, I mean, that's the thing is, yeah. It's not absolute in the wording. Mm-hmm. So I can even read it. If you'd like to hear the First Amendment.
Okay. All right. I want you to read it after it's I read not, this. No, please okay. do. Please do.
Yeah,
please
it's
do.
Certainly not absolute, but anything can be enshrined. I mean, the Ten Commandments are enshrined. Yeah. They don't cover like every bad human action or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, that's like the Mel Brooks.
Well,
joke,
there's
right?
only 10. There's only 10 we can't do. We can do everything else.
So that's the thing is like, those are enshrined, but they're not absolute.
Exactly. All right, so it says here, the First Amendment is not absolute, and in particular, does not protect intentional incitement to imminent violence. Conspiracy to commit violent acts, true threats directed at specific individuals, to physical obstruction or the exercise of constitutional rights, or intentional destruction of private or public property. Speakers have a right to advocate violence and hate so long as it does not fall in the above narrowly defined categories, which are cases involving conflicts among our values and priorities. Cases involving conflicts among our values and priorities. Would you consider that to be an absolute statement?
I mean, because their mission can change over time. So I think it like encompasses wherever their values are at the moment of the incident.
All right. Good interpretation. Okay. And it says, including but not limited to those involving free speech, equality, privacy, and religious liberty. Now, I would love for you to read the First Amendment, because I think that's
well,
a lot of this.
I will,
being,
but let me say, yeah, I
so
think.
Please, please.
So where they're headed, like where the ACLU is headed here is, there's a couple of things at work.
Yes.
One of them is essentially the modern instantiation of free speech. The modern instantiation of free speech in a legal sense really calls progressive organizations to do these types of gymnastics, because of course, they want to protect their right to organize for change. But in protecting that right, they also have to leave the door open for people who would like actively work against that effort. And so it becomes like, we know that these things harm, but we have to leave space for the harm. So that's why it becomes so much more narrowly defined. And we actually see that in the history of this law, these laws. And that's something that happens around the 70s, that the first narrowing, and then there's, you know, it, and so that's, it's like an important sort of turn in the way.
I agree. But now, let me just, as a slight sidebar, we have to define these things as our society and our culture evolves. Correct?
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I mean, because it's not really like, I mean, I'm not exactly sure 100% what you're asking, but like free speech itself, like, isn't, you know, it's something that was essentially like created, right? As governance itself was created, right? Like these rights maybe weren't manifest in like the natural world in such a way that, you know, like water and air and sunshine and all these other things, like good health, yeah, right?
That's kind of,
Even good health itself. Good health itself is something that was manifest at it, along with the industrialization of the world. So this is like an ideal. Free speech is an ideal. You know, in the same way that like sincerity is an ideal. So for it to be, you know, definable and or something that does not change over time is asking a little much.
I agree. Well, the question I'm going to ask towards the end of the show is, are we evolving or devolving? Now, here's the second point. Whether the speakers seek to carry weapons, I think that's a pretty good distinction. The impact of the proposed speech and the impact of its suppression. Now, this is what it says about that, and then I'd love your interpretation here. It says, our defense of speech may have a greater or lesser harmful impact on the equality and justice work to which we are also committed, depending on factors such as the present and historical context of the proposed speech, the potential effect on marginalized communities, the extent to which speech may assist in advancing the goals of white supremacists or others whose views are contrary to our values, and the structural and power inequalities in the community in which speech will occur. At the same time, at the same time, not defending such speech from official suppression may also have harmful impacts, depending on the breadth or viewpoint-based character of the suppression. The precedent that allowing suppression might create for the rights of speakers and the impact of the credibility of the ACLU as a staunch and principled defender of free speech. So, it says many of these impacts will be difficult, if not impossible, to measure. So now this speaks to your point. At a certain point, I mean, it gets pretty messy to how far do you go in defending somebody who definitely intends harm but wants to have the freedom to inflict.
And essentially, what we see happening here is, again, the ACLU applying this narrower standard. This standard comes out of Brandenburg from 1969, and they were previously not enacting that standard. And now they are. Which is the same thing. It's speech is protected until a speaker intends imminent lawless action. That is the test that's currently used today in our court. And the ACLU is walking all the way up to that line now.
I think there are a lot of things, you know, we just touched upon a few things that are happening in the news, and I know you have bullet points, and I want to get to every single one of those. But I do want to just back up for a second and look at international linguistics, human rights, and, you know, how that governance works in other countries. And, you know, there are things that we sort of take for granted here that you just definitely can't do in other countries. And then there are things that are happening in other countries that you can see could easily happen here. So I just want to, before I jump into anything, I just want to know if if there are any countries or laws or things that you are particularly paying attention to and how you think they may impact us.
I mean, no, not really. I mean, there's a handful of things that are happening right now in a number of countries, but I'm not, you know, like as a researcher really paying attention to anything in particular. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just don't know if you heard about this guy that they're calling the England and the free speech czar. Do you know about this guy? Okay, his name is Arif Ahmed. Okay, and he is... they've named him the free speech czar. He's a Cambridge philosophy professor, and he's become the government's first free speech czar. And it's the whole idea is he feels that there's a lot of lip service being paid to free speech, so he's going to use his role to stand up for all views. And I think that's going to be interesting because we did recently hear someone else call themselves a free speech absolutist, but, you know, at the end of the day, what makes, you know, it's such a hard thing to define. So, part of what I wanted to, so you never heard of this guy. You didn't know about any of this, you know? You're shaking your head.
No, I haven't. I'm sorry. No, I have not.
Okay. All right. Well, I think it's interesting. I want to come back to him. But this is, okay, I'm going to just read to you one of the things that he was in the news about. This was actually on June 1st, so this is recent. It says, and this is from the Daily Mail, it says, censorship at university is a threat to democracy, warns government's free speech czar. And he said, Professor Ahmed says freedom of speech is under threat on British campuses. Now, this is something we want to touch upon only because this is, I think, there are definitely some parallels to what's happening here in America. He says democracy is at risk, and this article is actually, I'm going to say it's by Martin Beckford, who's the policy editor for the Daily Mail. He says here democracy is at risk from censorship within universities, the government's free speech czar has warned. Professor Arif Ahmed said academic freedom and the freedom of expression are fundamental to civilization, but under threat on British campuses. In his newly created role, he will oversee investigations into the suppression of free speech at universities, such as talks on women's rights being canceled or academics being disciplined for remarks on social media. He stressed that he will defend the right for people to express all types of views, including post-colonial theory, as well as gender-critical feminism, which holds that humans cannot change sex. His appointment came yesterday after trans rights protesters interrupted a talk on Tuesday at the Oxford Union, where he was debating. Now, just from that little bit of information alone on him, what's your thought there?
Yeah, so you have jumped all the way to the end of my bullet points.
Oh!
This is exactly what is currently making its way into our courts as well. So this type of thing seems, I mean, it is talking about the university, for example, they're not protecting curriculum. They're protecting the people we invite to come to campus. And what I do as a professor to keep that separate from what I do as a human, that is what they're protecting. They are not protecting my right to teach whatever I wish. That is what academic freedom is supposed to be. And even though it's in this paragraph, that's not what this law does. This law seeks to punish people who want to stop people from speaking, which, in my opinion, is the freedom of assembly, right? And that's where they become very difficult to entangle because, again, it's a single sentence. You know what I mean? So, like, what is happening? The headline of this article is European language laws may threaten, you know, American free speech. And it's true because even though our courts are not supposed to appeal to international precedent, they absolutely do.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, that's exactly where I'm going. Now, you said this is one of your bullet points, but you said it's the very last. Okay, all right. So, well, that's where you feel we're headed. Well, I wanted to give context to show that this is, you know, we're it's beginning to happen here, but can you imagine us having such an appointment within our government, a free speech czar? Can you see that ever coming? Can you see that happening?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, me either. That'd be science fiction.
I mean, no.
Yeah, I agree. Okay. We're on the same page. All right, let me jump back
then. There's a reason we don't have a national language, okay?
Okay. Do you want to reveal that, or do you feel like it's obvious?
Another 2 hours.
Okay. So my question to you then is coming back to, you know, your bullet, because I have a number of them here, because I was going to talk about some European language laws that are dangerous to American free speech. But I don't want to jump too far afield of your bullet point. Did you have a bullet point you wanted to get to at the top?
I mean, we don't have to talk about this. I mean, it's just the history. I mean, I don't know if it's interesting. I think it's important.
I think context is always important. So
because it helps us like understand maybe what's at risk and why, like looking at these cases that are happening right now, it's really difficult to put them in context without understanding like how these laws have changed. Maybe that's not interesting. I mean, maybe that's not the linguistic question. So,
well, it's not so much a linguistic question, but I think it's important. I do think if you wanted to give a brief history lesson, I think it is important to have the context. And just for those who are listening, to have some context, you are listening to Night Shift, and this is listener sponsored radio, WBAI. I'm Mike Sargent. I am here with raciolinguist Dr. Kelly Wright, and we are talking about free speech and where we're headed. So.
Yeah. So I think like maybe one place to start is a lot of folks maybe look at this law or think about like what's prohibited and what's not prohibited as being a question of what is speech, or maybe like what is protected. And the exact words in the Bill of Rights are like abridging the freedom of speech. And I think really if we look at like the legal history of how this has been tested, is a number of folks, is like the difference between that question is like the freedom of is on one side and speech is on the other. So a lot of cases that have failed in the past have gone before the court and been like, this is speech and it should be protected. But the courts are more interested in protecting the freedom of than speech itself, which that seems like, how does that even work? You know what I mean? That's like
why I think the concept over the practice.
Yeah, the concept over the practice. And I think like part of the reason why like these initialists are these people who, again, like are currently on our court, but have always been on the Supreme Court, are looking at the concept and are attempting in some ways to preserve what like this would have meant to the framers. And to the framers, this freedom of is perhaps like this wider thing that was like really specific, even though we don't have any context for that. So they're trying to like, you know, intuit the minds of like enlightenment men. And we see this, the history of, you know, the Bill of Rights itself being like a compromise that was like, you guys totally want a centralized government. Okay. We're not going to come after you. And so this like thing, I mean, it immediately gets challenged. I mean, immediately the government starts hacking away at it. So we get the Bill of Rights in 1791. But by 1798, we have the Alien and Sedition Acts, right? That say like, you can't criticize the government publicly if it's going to threaten national security. And so like, you can say anything you want if you're just whatever, but if you're going to like get a whole bunch of people to do what you, if you're convincing, we're upset, right? And I think that that's maybe, you know, and that like morphs in World War I into the Espionage Act, which, and maybe we can stop here, but we get what I think a lot of people still today like keep in their minds about like speech that's illegal. And that we get from Oliver Wendell Holmes, like this, the clear and present danger test, And that clear and present danger test is like exactly that. Like this speech like presents like a clear and present danger. And it is that thing of yelling fire in a crowded theater. That's his example. That's Oliver Wendell Holmes, right? That's his example of saying you can't yell fire in a crowded theater if there's no fire. That is not protected speech because it's going to create harm. It's going to create a clear and present danger. And so, but that like doctrine gets applied for a really long time, right? To look at and like who decides is like these individual people on the courts, you know, circuit court, state law, you know, in, at the state level and then at the national level of saying, we think this is dangerous or we don't.
Again, yes. And what's also interesting about that too is, you know, that's really what the ACLU is still trying to define, you know, well, we support the concept, but there's so many ways in practice. And, you know, the other part of this to me is lying. We're free to lie. You're free to lie and say anything. And a lot of politics, you know, there's a great scene in not such a great movie. I forget the name of the movie, but it's about these people who, you know, they help political candidates get and win, you know, win over countries and topple governments and whatnot and win political campaigns. And they're reminiscing about a political campaign that they, and they're adversaries. It's a man and a woman. And they're reminiscing about a political campaign. And he talks about how great it was to have accused this candidate of like having sex with an animal or something. And he says, but nobody's going to believe that. He says, no, but I will love seeing him go on TV to deny it. You know, and so there it is. You know, once you've put it out there, are there people who are going to believe it? And once it's said, you know, you have the right to say anything. The aliens are coming. And if you could say you believe it. And so
So, I mean, again, like we do and we don't have the freedom to lie. Well, it sort of depends.
Yeah.
And honestly, so, and we know, okay, like certain, like some corporations cannot lie to us, like pharmaceutical companies. But other corporations can lie to us or allow us to be exposed to lies, and that's essentially social media. So from 1996, social media companies have had like a shield in our law to present known falsehoods to us, because as soon as that like doctrine, like we are responsible for the content we generate as individuals. And we also know that like corporations are people, right? And so that is what's like being teased out right now, is this idea that like currently, you know, if I am defamed, if I am defamed in the newspaper, I can't sue the newspaper, unless there's like these, again, like very narrowly defined, like recklessness, like obvious recklessness that I can demonstrate on the part of the paper. That was something that may have come up in this like Fox versus Dominion case, but it didn't because they settled, right? So that would have been in question. And that is very much on the table. It is 100% under threat that individuals could sue these corporations for defamation, which they can't in these instances, unless it's very narrowly defined. So they might open that up, and that directly threatens the freedom of the press, right? But what you brought up, this is happening like right now. There's this case about this guy who was stalking someone online. Okay. And stalking is like a very specifically defined crime that you have this, like, you have to have evidence like over time. So they very much use how somebody's language use against them. Right. Of saying like, clearly you were stalking this person. Like, look, you sent them a billion messages. They were threatened. You committed a crime. And that is 100% determined on impact. Impact. It's the victim that gets to say, I suffered and I am due whatever. This guy, this stalker guy, tried to make this argument that his speech was protected. His speech in these thousands of messages that he sent this young woman was protected because he didn't intend, his objective was not to create terror in her. That if she experienced terror, that's on her. But his speech itself is protected. And so we can't be, you know, like convicted of a crime. And he lost his case at the state level in Colorado, but SCOTUS took it up and they did not have to. Okay. They withheld his conviction, but that's just this guy. Do you know he put the argument out there? That argument's out there now, and people are going to use that argument as saying that my speech is completely protected and it does not matter how it hurt you. And that has been like the one thing at the center of our legal doctrine on this that has never changed. And it is absolutely up for change right now.
Now, to me, that's the irony, because now free speech itself has become weaponized.
I'm like, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's because it is so murky, people are able to use it to, you know,
just,
in my opinion,
just like the Bible,
make things harder.
Put it! For God's sake, Christian, wake up! Wake up! Wake up! Wake up!
People have been calling throughout the entire time we've been talking, by the way. So I'm going to actually give out the phone number, if you don't mind us taking some calls.
Great.
But we do have a lot of material to get through here. The phone number here is 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. I think somebody's already here. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Okay, nobody's there. So, we are talking about free speech. We are talking with Dr. Kelly Wright. Is there anything that you have that people can see or go to look or to hear any of your great speeches that you want to promote?
Oh, sure. I'm easily Googleable. Easily Googleable.
That's a t-shirt. I like that. I'm going to get that t-shirt.
Yeah. So I'm not the black guy who works for Fox News. I'm the other Kelly Wright.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I thought... kidding, Kat.
What?
No, I thought you were the black guy from Fox.
Oh, yeah, you know. We look alike. And then it's at Ratio Linguistic, LINGUISTIC, on Twitter, and that can get you to my website and everything else you need.
Okay. So I want to move on a little bit, and I know you had some, so we did get a little bit of context, and you gave us a little bit of the history, and there are some people calling. I'm going to see if we take one call here. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Hello? Okay. 212-209-2877. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
I can barely hear you.
Well, I'm here. Can you hear? I hear you.
Well, I just wanted to comment that statement about pharmaceutical companies can lie. What a bunch of crap. That's all they
ever do. I said can't lie.
That's all they do.
She feels that all they do is lie, Kelly.
Not within legal parameters.
They lie within legal. All right, was she hungry? That was, she felt strongly about that. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, I want to ask a question.
Okay.
What about the Dred Scott decision and the so-called free speech that he was denied his freedom as a slave? And what is her opinion on that? And what is that in relation to what's going on today with the states that are reprimanding all of the rights, or what they call it, the civil rights, or the Civil Rights Act that was done in 64. Why is these states trying to discard every action as far as knowledge about African history or people of color?
That's a lot of questions there.
Yeah, this is a great question. Okay, so the Dred Scott case.
I want to hear you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So the Dred Scott case, I think, is, at least in the mind of legal scholars, regarded as like the worst decision in U.S. legal history. And essentially what they say is that just because Dred Scott had lived in a free state, he was not a free man. Because he'd like made it to freedom, it didn't count. and that's like a really pedestrian way of describing this. But essentially what happens in this case is that the legality of black citizenship is denied. And what that means is that every right and promise that comes with citizenship, which again, still in our Constitution doesn't cover black people or women or anyone who is not a fair complexion person of European descent. In the words, not in practice, in the words, right? That by denying all black people the legality of the rights of citizenship, it means that they don't have anything that's in the Bill of Rights. They are not free. They're not free. I mean, and it was patently illegal. At this time, this is, you know, the 1857, we see the last laws, the laws that anti-literacy laws in the United States don't leave the books in the North until the 1840s and in the South until during Reconstruction, so after the 1870s. So, like, we're talking about this exact period where it was already, like, not legal to teach black people how to read. It was legal to dismember them as punishment. Like, this is just further enshrining the dehumanization, like the active dehumanization of black people right before, you know, we see like the Civil War jump out. So it has a lot, it's really an inciting factor because a lot of people really rose up and try to demand their rights, try to say, we are citizens, we have rights, we have, you know, we want these things that are enshrined for other people. after that, even though we don't talk about a lot of those rebellions, they absolutely existed and were a direct result of this, which this kind of thing, like asserting our power in this way, in the way that our very nation was founded, is exactly what's under threat now. You know, like the freedom of assembly, right? The freedom to, you know, criticize our government, et cetera.
Well, I'd like to ask you the last part of his question, how you feel it relates to today and what your thoughts are on, you know, somebody, the rise or the power of that somebody like DeSantis is using to, you know, become potentially, you know, today's George Wallace, and, you know, how just blatantly racist and dehumanizing these laws are. But he's playing to a base. He's playing to a base that exists. He's playing to a base that has always existed in this country. That is not, you know, fiction. So I'm, you know, do you feel it's just an obvious connection or just a continuation? Or do you feel like we're in for a new age of...
Well, I don't feel like the Southern strategy is new.
No, I don't feel so.
So, either. You know, he's playing with a well-worn deck.
You got to put a little accent with a well-worn deck. He's playing with a well-worn deck.
But, these bills, these things that are trying to be pushed through that really directly threaten the rights of individuals to like utter certain phrases in certain contexts that are really doing like a twofold sort of work of pulling new information out of like the view of younger generations. Which we talked a little bit about the last time I was on here. And then the other side of it, of really actually attempting to control speech, linguistic usage. And so for me as a linguist, right, as someone who studies, looks at language from the very first human being to use it till today. So it's a very long time, Def. Direct suppression of speech has never been successful. Never.
Well, you know, it's not successful for too long. One of the things that has happened down in Florida is that DeSantis got the judge he wanted, or he got rid of the judge he wanted to get rid of, in his free speech suit. But Disney's also has another suit against them from...
this to me is like one of the juiciest things that's ever happened.
Yes, all right. So I wanted to know the Sage Steele. You know about the Sage Steele of free speech battle. So she is an ESPN anchor and vaccine skeptic. And she's fighting with Disney about her free speech to basically... You know, in the height of the pandemic, she just said some things like they felt she shouldn't have said. So what are your thoughts on this battle?
I mean, again, it's a toughie. It's one where the reason why there's a case here.
And now keep in mind, she's a woman of color, for those who don't know. Okay. For those who don't know. Yes.
There's a reason why there's a case here. Right. Because it does like get at this like imminent lawless action, this understood recklessness thing of like, I was speaking my mind versus I was speaking my mind in a way that I intended to harm people. Like, I knew the vaccines were the best thing in the world. I totally believe that. And then I got up here and I told people not to get them because I wanted them to die. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I wanted them to experience harm. That's why there's a case here, because this person, they were like, no. Disney was like, no. And then this other person, you know, this person was like, I haven't, like, my speech is protected. My speech is protected because there was no, like, imminent harm. And their argument is, like, it's inherent. The harm is inherent. Which is, again, like very much where the ACLU is standing, like coming back to that of them being like, if people are holding weapons in front of your face, maybe you don't feel at ease to say whatever is on your mind. You know, it's this idea of like, right? I mean, yeah, there are countries where all of the military is heavily armed. They can like take your blood without your permission. You know, it's like that kind of thing of like, I'm going to be walking down the street and maybe I'm just going to keep my mouth shut. You know, it's like that of like, obviously the presence of a weapon, like, but that's the ACLU standard, not our federal government. Right? Like our federal government does not protect in that kind of nuance.
Well, that's what Alex Jones found out. So... So now, speaking also of how things in the past were handled and how we look at what was handled in the past now here in the present and what else is going on, what are your thoughts about what happened with the seventh grader and the t-shirt? Do you know about that? Okay.
This isn't the guy with a Z on his back.
That's No. That's another one. This is all right. This is a story from, also June 1st. Court denies Massachusetts seventh grader free speech request following legal battle over two genders shirt. Liam Marson, 12, is suing Nichols Middle School's officials for violating his First Amendment rights. This 12-year-old's lawsuit is for, they say he was wearing a shirt that said there are only two genders. And he is, and obviously they asked him to get rid of the shirt. He was forbidden to wear this t-shirt to school. And he is now suing the school. Now, what's your thought on that one? It's a slippery slope.
It is. I mean, again, like, my thoughts.
Are you looking this up now? I see you looking. Are you looking?
I was looking. I wanted to see what the shirt looked like.
Okay.
And he changed it to there are censored genders.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Sweet Liam. I think,
Sweet Liam.
At 13, right?
It's 12. Like, 12.
This is, yeah, it's, me as a person, I'm like, gosh.
Gosh is a good response. Okay. Well, all right. I got one more for you. Because, again, I think these are some interesting things that are going on here. There's one of the other big topics is social media. And how the speech police are coming after social media. So, of course, that means Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Before I read a little bit of this article from The Economist here, I want to know your thoughts on free speech and social media. What do you think? Because that's an even more complex issue because that, again, is a place where one of the things that I think about social media is it gives you anonymity. So you don't have to be John Smith. You can be, you know, Patriot Killer 1193, and you can say whatever you want behind the wall of this facade of whoever, you know, Captain America or the Punisher or whatever photo you put up on your social media. So what are your thoughts on those two things? Because one, you talked about language, and linguistics is language and body. Well, when you remove the body, and you now have an avatar, and you now have anonymity, you know, you're bolder, you can say whatever you want. So I want to know just your thoughts on
Remove the body. I'm sorry.
Okay, talk to me. Talk to me.
Behind an avatar,
yeah,
you're still producing language. You cannot produce language. Body. This is what the whole field of forensic linguistics is about, of trying to say, we saw how you use language, and we know who you are.
That's them using it against the rappers too. We know that language.
I mean,
know who you are.
I'm not trying to say that I agree with those principles. I'm just trying to say that every linguistic action presupposes an actor, and that it doesn't matter if I don't know exactly who you are. I still know that you're a human being. And that is maybe part of what's in question with bots, but bots are trained by humans and they learn on human language. fight me. There is a body involved in all language use. Okay. But your question about social media is interesting. It's one that, again, like 1996, we get section 230. And that's interesting in and of itself because this is where Congress steps in, right? So these other things are cases. They're cases. They're cases. They went before the Supreme Court or lower courts. This is where Congress steps in. And Congress says, we are responsible for our own statements online. The company that is hosting our statements online bears no responsibility for that. So that gives us the freedom to go out as and catfish and do and be an avatar and have no face and be Patriot Killer XXX, whatever, right? It's a shield, right, for the social media corporation, Section 230. Section 230 has been, is like up for review, is going to be reviewed very soon. Now, there's a couple like interesting cases in between against Twitter and Google, and they're about how real people, like people got killed in terrorist attacks because of information that was put online, right? And they're saying that Facebook, like, and Google, like, they, or Twitter and Google, like, bear some responsibility for that because these people essentially got, like, doxxed and then killed. But they sided with the corporations, right, of saying that, like, they didn't. They upheld Section 230. Right now, the state governments of Florida and Texas are both moving forward cases. They're on the docket currently that essentially try to give us the right, the government the right to force social media corporations to leave things up. So right now, they're being forced to take stuff down, right? Or some things they're taking down. But right now, we're wanting like the government to have, the government currently has like First Amendment responsibilities, but it doesn't really have First Amendment rights or actions. And these are trying to give the government action they can take like underneath this, which is essentially saying like this, the idea is, a white supremacist organization puts up a post and it gets flagged, you know, in the ways that we see it now where there's like a flag or it gets taken down. And this gives like a mechanism for that organization to petition the government to force Twitter to leave their stuff up. So people aren't getting deplatformed. People like, I don't know, our former president, Donald Trump. Do you know what I mean? Like this is a mechanism for that. Of allowing the government to force social media to comply and to leave up anything. I mean, they're absolutely cloaking this in free speech, right? Of saying this is a right for all. But we haven't seen these kind of things play out as rights for all. We've absolutely seen them play out on the sides of corporations. Like usage is freer for a corporation than it is for an individual right now. And it's been that way for 80 years?
What is advertising but not, you know, free speech? Like, yeah, our product's better. Our product's, you know, what do they call it? Greenwashing. So that's
a real thing. People are actually getting in trouble for that.
Yeah, it's a real thing, but it happens all the time.
You know why? Because it has to do with the corporation. And that's why people are getting in trouble for it. Because if we could trademark our, you know, Nest, then maybe it would have a little more teeth in the law.
Now, there it is. If everybody trademarked, you know, some aspect of themselves, and then you have to, you could charge for that information that you're giving away free on all those algorithms.
Well, I'm sorry I've hurt somebody's feelings. We should take another call.
You know, there's a lot of calls coming in. All right, I'm going to take a call here. The phone number is 212-209-287. We're talking with Dr. Kelly Wright, racial linguist. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Okay. Hello, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Mike. How are you? Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you? Who's this?
Can you hear me?
I hear you. Who is this?
You know,
what's your name, sir?
Comment about the First Amendment. You know, I think impliedly and suggestibility is in operation here, where it is given primacy. But you know what the real teeth of the matter is when it comes to linguistics and speech? It is congruent to freedom of movement. That should be the primary and First Amendment. The freedom of movement.
Yeah.
Language, speech is congruent to freedom of movement. You see that connect? Yeah.
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. And it points back to what our last caller had to say, you know, of this idea that, you know, like Dred Scott, he had like taken freedom of movement without having a right to it, an enshrined right to it. And so it was this question of like, well, now you've moved, so how do we address you? You know, you're in a different context, so do we view you in a different way? And the answer was blatantly no, right? We don't, yeah, anyway.
Yes, I think that was a very good point. I don't know if he's still there. Hello?
Well, and it's so much of what we see in, like, immigration and migration throughout all of time, right, is that I maybe use this example all the time, but like that process of like Egyptianization of like people who were brought into Egypt were made, you know, prisoners of war, but were also like turned into citizens, were turned into members of the lower class, and that their freedom of movement was restricted. And because of that, they were then like given an entire new set of ways of making language and culture and life. So like, because their movement was restricted, their language use was also like summarily restricted. They do very much go hand in hand.
Well, I agree. And in many ways, I mean, that's what we're seeing with these protests. If it depends on what you're protesting. If you have a KKK rally, you can walk down the street freely. But if it's a Black Lives Matter or an LGBTQIA or something that the cops in that town may not agree with, then you're going to get treated very differently. It's not free speech anymore. Your movements are being restricted.
Please don't get me started on the asymmetrical response to the Black Lives Matter protest versus January 7th.
No, I won't. Hello, you're on the air. All right, the phone number here, like we had 6 calls. I tried every single one of them. They wouldn't go through. I think we should have a special pledge drive for a new phone system. 212-209-2877. You are listening to Night Shift. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, yes.
Yeah, this is the same call about the Dred Scott.
Okay.
The one thing about it seems to be is that these laws were legislated by white people, whether they were Democrats or Republicans. And then we still have that same contrast, that same situation now. Now the laws are being abruptly changed to suit this certain situation now. Give one example. The right of a man stand your ground. If a man feels that his life is threatened, then he takes action, just like this guy, Daniel Perry. But he has had people supporting his case. They gave him money.
$1 million worth of support.
Yeah, okay, now, just what happened in the South when Emmett Till was murdered. And the people supported the men that killed him. And they were grown men. They killed a 14-year-old man, boy, and he was relegated to death by this, just like Daniel Perry made a chokehold. So these people are exonerated, and the laws seem to be against people of African people, not black people.
Is an understatement.
Well, it really is, because this is at the heart of, and thank you so much for saying this, because sometimes I feel like I have to like push this point home, that it seems apparent to me, but it's maybe like not apparent to others. I feel like if you actually do look at the timeline, and I encourage anyone who's interested in this to buy the book Fearless, buy, rent, download, steal the book Fearless Speech, Fearless Speech by Mary Ann Franks. She has really put together a comprehensive history that's very approachable. But this idea of...
Can I say this? If anything, most people need to read Dr. Joy DeGruy's book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, where she explains all of that away and shows you the current predicament that most people of African blood, along with the indigenous people of this land.
Sorry, I was writing that down. I'm glad you mentioned it. Point, what this caller brings up is there are maybe two cases that really stand out. One of them is against Anna Whitney. Anna Whitney was a suffragette, and she was spending her time advocating for racial equality based on the Black women workers' experience, which is itself a precursor of critical race theory, right? Like, this is proto-critical race theory. She's advocating for racial equality based on Black women's professional experiences, for pacifism in general. This is in the interwar period, and is arrested for speaking against the act of lynching in a California community college. So this woman, Anna Whitney, her conviction is upheld. It goes from the California court system to the Supreme Court, and her conviction is upheld. But in like, anyway, there's a lot of interesting parts of that ruling, right? Of all these things that kind of enshrine the way that we think about modern freedom of speech, but that the ways in which they were describing it didn't apply to her, right? Like they upheld her conviction, and in doing so, right, some of the most eloquent language we have in our law about what speech is and how it should be protected. So they are defining it in an effort to say that it does not belong to her. It does not belong to this person who is advocating actively for racial equality, right? And then that decision gets overturned, right? So we are free to advocate for racial equality these days, or I would already have a bullet in my head. This thing is a government, you know, bot. But this case, this Brandenburg versus Ohio case that I keep mentioning in 1969 is what overturns the precedent set in Whitney of saying that she had committed a crime. Right. When she gets arrested, she says, I have nothing to apologize for. I have nothing to apologize for. Right. She gets arrested. All this stuff happens. Brandenburg overturns that decision, and they overturn it on the base of supporting a KKK leader who called all of the journalists in his county down to a rally and went on national television and burnt a cross and advocated for, you know, used anti-Semitic and anti-Black slurs and advocated for like armed insurrection, essentially. What he calls it is revengeance. And he does not go to jail, right? He is convicted in Ohio, and that sentence is overturned at the Supreme Court level. So what we have here is the Supreme Court weakening the protections that people have, that before in Whitney, it was like very narrowly defined. And now they're making it more broadly defined by saying, or they're making it even more narrowly defined. It was broadly defined in Whitney, and they're making it more narrowly defined. That's where we get the thing of like imminent lawless action, which persists till today. So this very narrow definition of what it looks like was defined in support of the KKK, right? I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They said this hate organization has a bunch of rights. We have to actually fix what we took away from this white woman who was trying to tell us we had work to do as opposed to racial equality. They were like, we actually have to reach back 40 years and take that, make that available for everyone so this hate group can go on doing what it does. You don't get a decision like that unless the people in power benefit from what that hate group is advocating for. You just don't. And I'm not just saying that. there is international and historical precedent for it, right?
Well, I think in the end of the day, it really always comes down to who's going to benefit. Who's going to benefit from a law being interpreted a certain way? And who will benefit most? So that's really what it comes down to.
And that's why I think very few things are actually prohibited. You know, it's a short list. It's one hand, you know, defamation, obscenity, fighting words, fraud, and child pornography. These are the only things that are explicitly not protected, right? They're saying this kind of speech is not protected. Whatever speech is in these situations. So like, if you're talking about just five on one hand, that there are a lot of actions that do not fall in that category.
Yeah, but categories. I gotta say, you can get away with fraud. A lot of people do.
You sure can.
And a lot of people are still getting away with it. As a matter of fact, quite a number of people are been elected.
You can get away with insanity.
Yes, there's a lot you can get away with.
You can get away with defamation. You yes, know, you can. I mean, I could call Ron DeSantis the big old rubber chicken. I'm not going to jail.
That's right. Well, how do you know he's not a rubber chicken? All right. Well, let's see. There are some more calls coming in. Let me see if we can take another call. Hello, you're in the air. Hello, you're in the air. Oh, okay. The phone number here is 212-209-2877. And we are talking about free speech. And, you know, let me just say this. You know, one of the things as we're moving into the final sections here. Now, I know you, have you hit maybe half your bullet points? Have you hit some of them? Okay, good. Because you do it very smoothly, so I'm assuming you are. But talking about the future, you know, we were talking about what's happening in other countries. We talked about the past. And, you know, what are some of the fallouts of this restriction of movement, restriction of speech? Restriction of expression, and it brought up a phrase that you said you weren't familiar with, but I think you actually are. I just think it's just a phrase that they call it, and that is echolinguistics. And echolinguistics really, and what they call post-humanist advocacy, is really how does a language die? How does if the last native speaker of a language dies? That is something that happens literally all the time. And if we don't value language, we don't value the expression, we don't value everything that it came from, like the culture that it sprang from, where are we going as human beings? What collective knowledge are we really keeping? So there are a number of civilizations you read about where, like, in all the works of the knowledge of the civilization was burned when they invaded. So I just want to know what your thoughts are on echolinguistics, and do you see aspects of speech just being eliminated at some point, or do you not think it will work that way?
So I'm glad you asked me this, because the founder of echolinguistics, which comes out of like the 70s and 80s in our discipline, is Einar Haugen. And so my very first writing in the field, right, 2017, easily downloadable on my website and stuff, is like work that is like attempting to enshrine like Haugen's vision. So Haugen like works on, it has like essentially echolinguistics is centralizes a concern for biodiversity. So it looks at language as a natural product, which it certainly is, and looks at all of these reasons, social, institutional, evolutionary, that cause a lack of biodiversity. Meaning that like there are fewer and fewer languages over time, and like new, or in the modern world even, and like new languages aren't like rising to kind of replace them. So we see like in the evolution, like right now, today, at this moment, there's about 700 plus languages being used, actively used in the world. that is not all the languages that are like real or available. So there's this idea that we're maybe only counting things that have like official recognition. That's one thing. And then there's this other idea that, and then you take that, like the number of languages we're officially counting, and then you go all the way down to the idea of an idiolect, which we've talked about on this program before, is like an individual's very specific language system that is like, you know, original to their
like Snoop Dogg. Snoop Dogg's got an idiolect.
Yes, that is like only happening in one person's brain, right? That's like your externalization of thought. Like nobody else's thoughts are yours. So you have your own linguistic system. Like it's self-contained. It's in your brain. You could use it without another person, right? That like expanse is sort of what ecolinguistics is trying to cover. So this idea that like every single human being has a fully functioning, self-contained linguistic system that contributes to the overall evolution of the species. All of that information is interesting. All of that information is worth studying and capturing. And then you have like the other end of it where like, it's like you said, like here's all the shit that didn't burn. Like here's everything that was burned. Here's all the things that didn't burn. Here's everything that was like the historical sociolinguist as I work to bring in that past social knowledge, that all of those like idiolects is what we're like trying to fill in the historical record that has like left everything. So we get, ecolinguistics is really interesting to me because it takes as like a starting point just supporting multilingualism from a policy perspective, which again, like this started in the 70s. We have not really seen this enacted in real time because it's incredibly difficult to convince governments to support languages. And so one of my first works is on Ghana, heavily multilingual space. And it's like that. The reason why I'm applying this is there are 140 languages that, you know, exist in the space of Montana, but only five are represented in official government policy. So I said, like, there's a reason why English is not our national language in the United States is that as soon as it becomes our national language, our government has a responsibility to issue all documents in that language and to make sure that every single human being in this country uses it and can use it for their official integration with the government. So you have a country that has five national languages. That country has to produce all of its official government materials, all of its road signs, all of its, you know, emergency broadcasts, all of its voting materials, all of that has to be done in all of those five official languages. And because we have never made an official language here in the United States, our government does not have those responsibilities. And so none of that information has to be standardized, which is why everywhere that you've voted, it's looked a little different, right? Is because we've never said, this is what we do. Our government has never taken up that responsibility, but almost every other government has, basically since the beginning of time.
Could you see some congressman deciding to put that as a measure to make English the official language? And could you see that happening? And that it
the
has
reason
to be
why
spoken?
It has not happened yeah. is exactly what I just described.
Okay,
there have been like many, many efforts for English to be the national language over hundreds of years, right, in this country. And none of them have succeeded because the government don't want to print that stuff.
Gotcha.
No one's will is ever going to outwill the, you know, stagnation.
Economics of that. Okay. All right. Good. Good to hear. All right. The phones are lighting up. Okay. Let's see if we can get one of these calls. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Hello. Hello, you're on the air. All right. Hello, you're on the air. All right. Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is the same caller.
All right. Well, you must have some. All right. Wait. Hold on. I got to try something.
Listen,
else.
One,
nah, I got to try somebody. You got to give somebody else a chance. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, yes. Who is this?
I'm Mike. Hi, Rachel. You know, I have to make a comment again. I called earlier about speech being cognate or congruent to movement.
Yeah, wait. You know, what's your name? Wait, sir, sir, what is your name? You didn't give out your name before.
I'm Mike. It's Gregory.
Oh, Gregory. All right, Gregory. Go ahead.
Yes, it must be understood that speech is divinely existential. And when a qualifier is attached to it, freedom, particularly, to speech, it becomes a political construct, a juridic entity. So because speech is divinely existential, people have to own that prerogative. And most are we... I guess we're conditioned to believe that it is a grant of government or some political construct to give us freedom of speech, but it is universally existential. It is our prerogative. And one of those poignant facets of speech is that divine prerogative of no. And when we own that prerogative, no, then it begins to establish defenses against encroachment, particularly by governments and other entities that would curtail speech. So we need to begin to look away from political constructs in thinking that they have to give us the grant of freedom of speech.
I concur.
Yeah, and I think... Oh, go ahead.
No, no, I was just saying I concur with that.
Yeah. I'll just hang up.
Yeah, I do. I think that in some ways, there are many individuals who, like legal scholars and others, who would agree with you in that this is what that the freedom of part is supposed to be protecting. Like, it's an inalienable right. It's part of our nature. We're never going to be able to suppress it. And so... this like wider and very specific concept, like for the framers, that very much had to do with like divine gifts. I think is part of what many on that like initialist side are making this argument. I'm not trying to say that that's where you stand. I'm just saying that I think that like that same line of reasoning is applied there.
I agree. Now, let me ask you this next question. Well, actually, I do see that some of the calls are. Let's see if I can take one of these calls. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Hello. All right. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, this is Joe from Elizabeth.
Joe from Elizabeth. You actually got through.
Yes. What I'd like to just make an observation is that as long as we as a country are going to uphold free speech as a fundamental principle, I think that along with that, we have to realize a couple of things, which I think a lot of people don't realize. Number one, people are going to lie. People are going to say hateful things. It's really impossible, in my opinion, to regulate that. If you allow free speech, you basically have to be ready for what you're going to get. And so what I think we need to elevate in people is the awareness that just because it appears or you hear it doesn't mean it's true, that you need to establish to vet it. You need to check it. You need to say to yourself, does this make sense? And I think that that's what people are not doing because maybe, you know, they weren't trained. I think it's great that in schools they are training kids to be critical of what they're seeing, to apply tests to it, to try to see whether, you know, it makes sense to them or not. And because otherwise, I really don't think there's any way to regulate free speech. I don't want to see it go away, but it's just that along with free speech comes a lot of stuff that we need to teach people how to deal with.
Well, I agree 1,000% with what you're saying, I think. But the other part of it is an educated republic is not as easy to control. So it makes much more sense to not encourage critical thinking, so that what people do have a tendency, human beings have a tendency to believe what they want to, you know. And I've experienced this in a number of situations, both tragically, amusingly, and in all kinds of ways. So, like you said, yes, human nature has to be factored in. Human beings will lie. There will be people who will say things. They will. People will say that Kelly is a giant rubber duck, and she's not. So, Kelly, did you have any thoughts on what?
Yeah, I thank you, Joe. It's good to hear your voice again. I definitely do think that this is a thing. I mean, one of the first things I said is I have such a hard time with this. I have a hard time defining it. I have a hard time wrapping my head around it, because I am very acutely aware, from my discipline at least, of the difficulties in regulating speech, or at least even those five things that I mentioned, you know, defamation, obscenity, fighting words, fraud, child pornography, those things have been porous and have each individually been attended to in our law, like over time, and will continue to be, right? It's going to remain in flux. But very often in my work, many people come up to me and they ask me for like a list of words we can't say anymore, or the exact way to write a policy so that like everyone is included. And I can't do that because A, I'm in the present. So I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I can't give you a policy that's going to be good for all time. And I think that that's like really reflected in, at least if not, like the intent or outcomes of these individual cases, that like their nature, and at least that many of them have been trying to address like what's permitted and what's not permitted. And it's so very difficult to give that list. It would be difficult to give that list in a perfect world, right? Where power imbalances didn't exist and we weren't like as worried, because as you know, as Joe mentioned, like people are going to lie. People are going to mislead each other, even with the best of intentions, even when there wasn't like X, Y, and Z reasons, right? Mistruths happen. And harm happens. That's like, for me, all this sort of stands against, again, like as a scientist, I know that hate speech has physiological effects that we see in the moment when somebody hears a slur that calls them out. It hurts. It literally like causes pain that gets sent into the mind. That sort of thing doesn't happen when they hear slurs that don't pick out their identity categories, right? It happens when it's something that actively wounds you, because words do hurt. And so there's this thing of, I know that this hurts. I know it hurts in the moment. And then we've also seen things like evidence of the Holocaust in the genome, right? Of something that like, when an entire group of people, an entire race is actively suppressed over time, like you know, that death by 1,000 cuts, those individual moments of pain leave their mark in our epigenetics. They leave our mark in how all of those people anticipate the world after this. And that to me is like, okay, I may not be able to give you the perfect law that will last forever, but I certainly recognize that one is needed. I certainly recognize that there are some things that cause harm. It's just that because it's so individualized, How do we write something that protects everyone? That is literally unit 4 in my class, is like, now that you've learned everything, could you please write some laws for a better world? Because, you know, I want everyone taking up this question. These are the things I want people writing their lawmakers about, is like, can we sit down and start thinking about this in a purposed way, which I'm not sure we've ever done.
And when are you announcing your candidacy for president?
President of what? NBC? NBC.
So, well, you know, you said a few things there that I wanted to touch upon, but I do see we're still getting a bunch of calls, and I think our caller is still there. Did you have anything more you wanted to say, sir? All right, I don't know if he's still there then. Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. We've been talking with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is a raciolinguist and... Are you still there, Kelly? You disappeared. Oh, okay, there you are. Okay. Who is a raciolinguist and a professor. Like, what besides being a raciolinguist, what else do you consider yourself to be?
Well, I'm a lexicographer because I write the dictionary. I write for dictionaries. So I'm a word historian.
A lexicographer.
Yep, and it's cography, like cartography. You know, I'm a word mapper, so that's fun. So I do that, and I also do, like I said, historical sociolinguistics. I mean, raciolinguistics is really a method. So that's like something that I apply to the different like types of inquiry I'm interested in. Really, I'm just the biggest language nerd you'll ever meet. Just enthusiastically excited and full, just bursting with knowledge about how these things work. So thanks for giving me some space to let it out.
Wow. We've enjoyed it. We're going to take a few calls here. The phone number is 212-209-2877. But one of the things I've pulled from this is that essentially, free speech is a concept. And it is a concept that is policed by, let's just say, a culture that has certain values. And it's an interesting parallel because we talk about free speech and every one of these shooters has like some manifesto that they have written. That espouses all their beliefs and everything they're thinking. And they're just, that's their free speech. They're just acting on what they think. But the question really is, then free speech is really the larger, the collective ideology telling you what is okay to say and what isn't okay and who can say what and when. The future, Kelly. Where are we headed? That's the real question for Night Shift.
Well, and I think, at least for me, it gets to this last part of what you said of that, you know, who is free to do what, where, and what does that look like? So in a lot of my work, I sit down and interview people about how they use language. That's one of my very favorite things to do. It's like the most rewarding part of my job. And the people I am most interested in speaking with right now are the ones who are living, you know, out loud, who are, you know, balking these trends, who are saying gay as loud as they possibly can, who are just embodying all of these things that seem to be very much under threat, who are exercising their rights of free speech in every aspect of their being, like all day long, knowing that they are at real risk, knowing that other people who have done so have died for it and recently. These are the people I want to talk to about how they're using language. These are the people I want to get in a room and you know, really think about, like, how aware are you of where these risks lie and how they influence, like, the ways in which you exist in the world. One thing that came out of my previous research on Black professionals was that Black professionals use the language that is truest to their identities about 4% of the time. So this is, you know, 96% of the time, I'm either silent or using language that is not true to my identity for a number of reasons, right?
Code switch.
There's a 300-page paper on their motivations if you're interested.
Well, that would fall into code switching, I would say. Now let me ask you something.
But is it code switching if it's part of how you have to live? That's really the open question.
No, I agree. I mean, they call it code switching. I've been doing it long before they called it that. You know, I've been very often the only in a space or the first in a space, you know, or the starter Black friend. But let me ask you this. How, you know, you talked about linguistics. You've boiled it down often to the study of language, you know, and movement. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the role listening plays. Because listening, you know, in audio, you know, I work for an audio company, we do podcasts, and when we have conversations, they talk about writing for the ear. It's a very specific way of writing. It's not just writing for the eye. writing for the ear is a very specific thing. So it engages. It's the same words, but you're writing for the ear because you know people are going to hear it. So listening is a part of linguistics, and I just want to know your thoughts on that, considering people are listening to us right now.
Haha. Well, so, okay, so I'm also a phonetician. This is like my training is in phonetics, which is the science of speech. And the science of speech tells us that listening is, you know, 9/10 or whatever. People are going to come for me because I said that. It's really this idea. When we look at like the cycle of I flap bits of meat around in my face and it creates like a pressure wave that then crosses the room and, or, you know, half of the country and filters through your earbuds into your ears and does things, right? It moves a membrane and you electrochemically transduce like what's happening right now. You are doing most of that work. You're doing most of that work. You, the listener, are doing most of that work. You are the most important part of this communicative process. The like dialectic of language production, if you want a big fancy word for it, is, and there's wait, so many books on this.
So instead of like saying during the show, during the dialectic production of this, broadcast. Okay,
this dialectic
production of this linguistic process, I, said to you.
Yeah, it really stems from like, the ways in which we think about like the relationship between art and the artist. So, you know, the artist like put something on canvas, but then it lasts for all time. And, or if we're lucky, and every single person who encounters it like has a different experience. So we can like think about the listener in very much a similar way. And there are a lot of people who have theorized like this idea of like the listening subject, that I don't even really maybe have to be in direct conversation with someone, but I am like anticipating how people are going to hear me or receive me. And so that has a lot to do with how I like construct self or like do self because of like who might be listening. And that's very much at the heart of the kind of work that I do, because I look at like the historical construction of something like Black femininity. And then like as a Black woman, like how do I do self in the world when I know that these types of listeners are out here, like these cisgender white males, these white women, these other people who are like in power, and I'm going to have to interface with those power structures because I am slick with them. I'm in this ocean, right? Like this is what I swim in. So it really constrains the ways in which I'm able to live. That is like exactly what I look at, right? Is this thing over time about how who we are really conditions how we're heard or how we're seen. And we could spend a whole nother, you know, episode talking about what that looks like over time and how it changes for different people. But essentially what it comes down to is A, there's no two individuals can make language in the same way. We could read the same two sentences and they would never be the same, right? We could be identical twins and read the same two sentences and they would never be the same, right? Because we're not the same people. And so because of that, you know, that really points to all these other, this points to how important the listener is. The listener's like primacy in this whole like thing. And our law points to how important the listener is, right? Because they're most concerned with harm. Even though maybe it doesn't play out that way, that's, you know, what the doctrine is. So it's like, it really is like part and parcel to like how things are received matters so much more than how they're produced.
We'll be right back. Well, that you're right. We could definitely have a whole show just to talk about that. And let me ask you another question, almost unrelated. Do you find you want to express yourself very differently in speaking versus writing? Do you think differently? How do you process words and your speech?
That's a good question. I would say I do a lot of different types of writing. And there are some instances where I can be closer to myself. Science writing is not that space. It is very difficult to incorporate one's identity into, you know, so-called objective work, right? Of this idea that I, the researcher, am not a person with an identity. I am just a person with like objective rational thought. And then this, and the other, and on the flip side, this other idea of, and the people that I brought in to generate this data are also not people. They're just data points. They're just a perceiver who was doing this one task that I engaged in. They certainly didn't bring their whole body into my lab. That's, you can tell how I feel about this. It's very difficult for me to, you know, put on the lab coat in my, to put the lab coat on my writing. That was a skill that I had to learn. And thank you, Dr. Patrice Beecher-Bedore, for bringing me there. Couldn't have done it without you. But it's very that of, it took a long time, but there are absolutely aspects of myself that make their way into my writing. And I would say that the dictionary is surprisingly one of those spaces. So my perspective is really valued in that organization. They want people who, you know, I grew up in the South. I grew up in Appalachia. I'm a dialect user through and through, right? And because of that, they're really interested in my perspective. And so I get to forward it. And not only in the work that I do, but in how I write about terms that are codified, right? So it depends, but it is always something that I must be aware of.
Okay, interesting. Well, I did have one last topic we were going to touch upon here just to finish the show. And I'm sorry our phone system doesn't work because we had tons and tons of people calling. Your thoughts on, you know, banning approaching people outside abortion clinics or outside voting, you know, how is it those free speech, you know, there's the two sides, like the people who are going to heckle you when you're there, and then the people who are going to try and be supportive or, you know, give you water while you're waiting. And so what are your thoughts on those two sides of free speech banning?
This is exactly where we see the roughness, the murkiness happening, because I mean, I'm a Catholic. I'm a lifelong Catholic. I know that my churches that I have attended in the past have organized exactly these kinds of, you know, events, and that the people who stand there, I'm not among them, but the people who stand there believe what they are sharing with folks, that they're about to commit a murder. And a lot of people do like come to those spaces and say what they say from a place of real conviction, right? That they actually, it's not that I hate you. It's that I actually believe that you're about to do something you're going to regret, and I want to help you not make that choice. Which, for people who have ever had to make that choice or know people who have, that's some bullshit. Oh, sorry. That is, that's like, it's not what you want. It's not what you want in this moment, right? It's not helpful. People have already made those decisions, and they've already been through everything that you could possibly say to them, you know, and it feels like it's absolutely oppression, right? I have volunteered to shield people from that, right, in the past. And it's a very dangerous space to be in. So legally, their speech is protected. You know, these people who protest, their speech is protected. I think that the best that they'll get is like a distance. You know, like you can't advocate for a political campaign within however many yards of a voting booth. It's going to be something like that is the best case scenario for these types of things that just moves a protest farther away from the individuals they're protesting, because those rights can't be infringed upon. If you infringe on the rights of those people who are protesting abortion, then the rights for all protests will be eroded. And again, this is what I mean about the murkiness is you, and it really points to what I was talking about, like this most eloquent, like doctrine from Brandeis about the best answer to bad speech is more speech, which I don't know how I would feel about that. But this is like part of how this is maybe enacted is, you know, people have a right to free themselves from the bondage of irrational fears. That's like his wording. And this idea that like reason will win out.
The bondage of irrational fears. I like that.
And his argument is like to preserve democracy, we have to preserve this healthy debate. And so this idea of like these people who are saying, you need to be saved, and me being like, I don't need to be saved from anything. I'm about to save myself. You know, that debate on, you know, actually like equal and equitable terms or whatever is something that needs to be had, deserves to be had, is part of the furthering of democracy, right? But there's a lot of things that haven't put us into that ideal space yet. So maybe we'll get there. Maybe the only way out is through. But that's a lot of pain for a lot of people.
That's an understatement. There are a lot of things that haven't put us in that ideal space yet. Yes, I agree. Well, I have to say, this is, for me, this has been a great conversation. We've been talking about, you know, the beliefs versus manifestos, the dominant manifesto versus personal beliefs, and how do we keep free speech yet diffuse hate? How do we do that? So, Dr. Kelly Wright, thank you for being here on the show.
Thank you for having me on this, like, this topic that was burning a hole in my pocket.
Okay. So we will be back here. Dr. Kelly, you will be back again, of course. She gave a thumbs up just for those who can't see through the radio. She just gave a thumbs up, just so you know. And I'm Mike Sargent. This has been Night Shift. We are here on Mondays from 10 p.m. till midnight. And if you've enjoyed this show, please consider making a pledge in the name of Night Shift. You can call now, 212-209-2950, and make a pledge. Become a WBAI buddy in the name of Night Shift. Make a $30 pledge. Just pledge $30 a month. It's a lot less than whatever you used to pay for cable, because you probably don't pay for cable anymore. So just become a WBAI buddy. 212-209-2950. Until next time.